Now, just a couple more stories here. Jacob. He prepares to cross the Jabbok Gorge to enter in the promised land. He's been 40 years or something in exile in what we now call Syria, where he married and brought up his family and everything. And now, because he fled Esau, and now he's been instructed by God to come back to the... So he's now on the verge of entering the promised land, and he's got to go through this big... across a bridge, across the gorge. And it's a little bit like Lord of the Rings. You know, he's kind of... it's not an easy thing to do. And he's facing his own demons in this daring to come into the Holy Land. That's the story. So he has to wrestle with the demon, or the angel, whatever it is. He has to wrestle. The wrestle's going on in here, of course, and it's about our life. He never discovers the name of the being with whom he struggles all night long. And we don't discover it either. So if you've got any questions about that next week, I refuse to answer them. Because nobody knows. We're not told. And that's how it is in life. This is how things are in the night. We don't know how to name things in the dark. We're never quite sure why this happened or whatever. This is how things are. Jacob emerges from the struggle with a new wound. His thigh is limping from the struggle. So he's lost something in it. He's also got a new name from Jacob. He's now called Israel. And he's got a new blessing from this struggle, this temptation, this trial, which can only mean a sharing in the strange divine power of the one with whom he is struggling. So whatever you make of that mysterious, extraordinary scene, beautiful, powerful drama scene, he comes through stronger from the struggle. And maybe that's the way it is. The new wound, linked in verse 32 with a food law, which is found nowhere else in the Bible, so we don't know where that comes from, it concerns his thigh. It's possible that the intended reference is to the genitals. They tended, as we often have, to have euphemistic terms. The life that Jacob will hand on, and this has got something to do with circumcision too, the wounding of the genitals, of the male genitals, and keep remembering that they had a wrong biology right through. They just presumed that the semen of the male actually contained human life. It's a very important bit of information to have in all this reading. And that the woman simply received it and nurtured it like a garden. They didn't know anything about the ovum or the gametes and so on. So under that assumption, necessarily, for example, God had to be imagined as male, because God's the source of life, not the receiver of life. Our problem is that as we discover more and more things through science, we keep the same mythology going. We keep the same images that come from an outdated biology, and because they've been there so long, we don't join the dots, you know? We've got our brains divided up, and we've got all our images over here and all the facts of life there, and if you don't put them together, well, you're living in it. But we've got to try to, and that's what theology is all about, I guess. The life that Jacob will hand on, Israel will hand on, through the children, the 12 tribes and so on, will always bear the marks of the struggle that he had this night on the borders of the promised land. We might recall Paul's words, "Yahweh said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, my power is made perfect in weakness." And you probably find, I think we'd probably have an agreement on this, that often it's our weaknesses that are our strength, if we can dare depth them, because it's what we actually share, our weaknesses. And that can be our strength if we own them and don't pretend or wear a mask or be a perfectionist or all the other things that we human beings perhaps might be inclined to do. A little, pardon me, Saints, but I remember, and Darcy and Aileen, you'd be part of this. Well, not Chevalier, but I taught their son hundreds of years ago. I used to notice when I was teaching, I was a pretty good teacher. I liked the kids and they had plenty of fun and they learnt a lot. That was all right. But every now and then this would go. When I get crook, which is so rare, thank God, my voice is often the first thing to go. And I found out, by the way, here's a little secret you can know, that my vocal cords are actually, that's why it's a bit like a South Sea Island sexy voice, have you noticed? No, my vocal cords aren't quite like flush. They're like that a bit. So when I sing, I can bring them together and get reasonable sound. But often it takes me a bit more energy to talk than it might take other people, clearly, and it's a bit husky and all that. Why did I tell you that? Oh, yeah, because when I'd get this going, and I still had to teach every period in the day, we didn't kind of let anybody off, I'd say to the kids, take me gently because I've got a weak voice, and just go gently. They always did. They always did. I don't know why. I just think because I was being honest with them and they thought, oh. So, because they probably thought my only means of control with a bad voice would be worse than anything. I don't know. Anyhow, I think we understand each other's weaknesses if we're... and we had a lovely priest who had manic depression. I was with him in the parish. We both worked together in the parish, and it was a strange business because no one was really appointed parish priest. So I agreed that he ought to be the parish priest because he was older, but I actually did all the decision-making, because he was... whatever. So we had this good system going. But he was very honest with people. He'd just say, I've got this... And once you knew, everybody was gentle and... you understand, don't you, that? They kind of understood the human weakness that he owned so simply. And I suppose that helped them own their weaknesses. Whereas if you pretend... anyhow, that's enough said on all that philosophy. The new name that he received is Israel, linked with the verb to struggle and the word God. It's got a couple of perhaps etymological meanings, but Israel probably means the one who struggles with God. And so you've still got the struggle with God going on. I read a letter this morning by a Canadian Jew. Got it off the internet, maybe you do too, but I get this stuff sent through from our MSC. I think this might have been Jewish. Anyhow, it was a young Jewish Canadian talking to his parents and in a letter, open letter kind of thing, and saying how he and his companions refused to go on with what they were saying. They love them, but they're not going to play it anymore. And they're naming Zionism for what it is. And how can an oppressed people, in the name of God, oppress another people? It's very enlightened and very good and very wholesome stuff. And hopefully there is a generational change that might take over and they may refuse to go along the Zionist line, which uses religion for its own political purposes. So, anyhow, the new name here is Israel, the one who struggles with God. His life and the life of the Israelites is one of constant struggle with God and with humans. God will be with Israel and Israel will prevail. In the words of the prophet Isaiah, Jacob strove with the messenger and prevailed. This story speaks of prayer, which can often feel like a struggle. It's another image for prayer, the struggling with God. Who are you? Why? What? And if that's how you feel in prayer, I'm not giving advice, but I'm saying don't be polite with God. If you've got a swear word for God, he can cope quite easily. So be yourself with God, and God isn't offended by naughty words or immaturity or anything. God is your father, so give it to him. Give him the word. Say how you feel and get it off your chest. And then God will come and give you a cuddle or something. But, we're not supposed to respect God. We're supposed to love God. Get me? Is that all right? He's not like a potentate sitting on a temple that you've got to be bowing to. And God is beyond our ken and beyond our control because God is full of mystery. And the last one before the break, that'll take us some time, is the beautiful Moses. What can we learn from Moses about prayer? There are many stories about Moses that offer insights into prayer. On Mount Sinai, Moses sees the fire in a bush, but the bush isn't completely consumed by it, or not consumed at all by it. And you know the story, I presume. Mm-hmm. Moses goes to investigate and he encounters God, who tells him to remove his sandals because he's on holy ground. God introduces himself as the one who has observed the misery of the people in Egypt, has heard their cry, and is determined to redeem them. And he's chosen to do this through Moses. Moses wants to know God's name. But we can't name God. You've probably got roses in your backyard and you might get a little, etiquette do they call it, a little name, anyhow, that you stick to it so you know the name of the rose. By all means, name the rose, name the animals, name the rocks. But you can't name God and pigeonhole God. We can't do it. Moses must be content to know that God is with him, and that's the only answer he gets. Something he will discover only by stepping out in faith. And the name, inverted commas, Yahweh, whenever you use the word Yahweh, translated in the Greek by Kyrios, so the Lord, but it's not a good translation, because it gives you a male translation of status rather than a personal encounter. Yahweh is a personal name. It's what you call God. But whenever you call God Yahweh, you have to think of this scene. Because it means the one I can't name, the one who is determined to redeem, the one, the God of the burning bush. That's what it always means. And all those images should be in your mind when you use it. When you say the Lord, none of those images are present. You're just back into some medieval or Renaissance European whatever. And Yahweh can mean Eyeh Asher Eyeh in Hebrew, I am who I am, or more likely, I will be who I will be. What is your name, says Moses, and God says, I will be who I will be. You just walk and I'll be there with you and you'll discover me as you journey. But you can't name me. You got it? So it's not a name, it's a remembered encounter that stops us using a name so that we can trust God will provide and walk into the future. Moses resists God's call. He offers excuses. They're quite comical in a way, but they're real and they're just like us. Not me. Yesterday we had the gospel, didn't we, of the Matthew? Hope you've been to Rome, and if you have, I hope you've been to the San Luigi dei Francesi, the national French church in Rome. And there's a chapel with three Caravaggios in it that you can't miss. You're not allowed to miss Caravaggio because he's just so good. Tragic life he lived, but out of his own tragedy, when he painted it, oh God, like it's just out of this world stuff. So out of the pain, you know, can come marvellous stuff. And he's got this, the calling of Abraham, and I've got, when you look at the painting this way, over there is Jesus with Peter a bit obscured, just his head and all that. And over there is Matthew at the customs house with one hand on the dough, and there's another bloke leaning over counting it. And there's a picture of Caravaggio as a young man gazing at Jesus. Beautiful young face, you know, like he's almost copying all the light. It's really lovely. It's either Caravaggio or Caravaggio's son. I think it's Caravaggio. So he's there and Jesus is going, Brian, I'll do it to you. Good luck. He goes like that. And Matthew's going... Like, what do you want? me for God's sake? I'm not allowed into the synagogue. I'm wrapped up with money. I know I'm okay on finance when it suits me, but I got no virtues. I mean, there's all those holy people. There's a whole temple full of them. You know, go and get somebody. And the gospel says, and he followed him. Jesus wasn't mucking around. So there it is. He called him. And Mal uses often excuses, but finally God says, no, you, the one I want. He finally gives in, and the mission will succeed, not because Moses is doing it with all his wonderful gifts, but because it's God's mission, and Moses will have to walk in faith. Don't we all? It will only be when he returns to the sacred mountain, that's the mountain of Sinai, where he encounters where the burning bush is, that he will see that God is indeed with him. So that's a beautiful story of prayer. Another story in Exodus 17 highlights the power of intercessory prayer. The Bedouin Amalekites coming in on their donkeys, or it was too early for camels, so whatever they were on anyhow, attacked the camp of the Israelites. And Joshua is leading the defense. That's where Joshua first appears in the story. Moses is up on the mountains, quite good, with his arms raised in prayer to God. One arm to God and the other one's got the staff. You know, the staff that he has where he separates the waters of, you know. Okay, and he's got the staff like this. And while he's there doing that, the Israelites are winning. He gets a bit tired. Try it for a while. And his arms start to sag. And then the Amalekites start to win. So he gets up again. So finally, it's really good. Aaron and Hur, they sit him on a rock and they prop his arms up. That's true. It's just a wonderful story. And so the Israelites won. Now, it's cute. It's a story you'll never forget. It's a story. Got it? It's not something that happened. But the story is saying something truthful about how we need each other to pray and the power of prayer, etc. The intimacy of Moses' communion with God is expressed in the following text, chapter 24. Moses went up to the mountain. The cloud covered the mountain. The glory of Yahweh settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. It's a story. And on the seventh day, of course, that we've got 7 days because of the moon. Don't blame God for it. The sun had nothing to do with time because they couldn't work it out anyhow. It seemed to come up and go down every day and didn't know anything about it. With the moon, you could tell because it would change the phases of the moon. And roughly speaking, full moon would be once every month, M-O-N-T-H, moonth. All right? So that's what happened. So they could tell the time. The next full moon will be the feast. And as soon as up on the hill just outside Jerusalem, as soon as they saw the first little bit of the new moon, then they knew, right, the month is starting, and 14 days time we'll have the full moon and the celebration. That's how they knew. They didn't have clocks, you know that. So for 6 days, they divided into four phases of the moon, half full, half new, etc. But on the seventh day, he called Moses out of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of Yahweh was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. There are no videos. There's no tape recordings. Nobody remembered being there. It's a story about all of us. Moses entered the cloud and went up onto the mountain. Moses was on the mountain, of course, for 40 days and 40 nights. Remind you of Jesus, I hope, the temptations, etc. The story, Elijah going 40 days and 40 nights to the mountain. This is all symbolic language which has a clear meaning once you read the drama of the Old Testament texts. The best way to start reading the Old Testament is to presume that it's all story. Now, there will be bits of fact in it, as there is in every story. It'll be based on legends, which are based on events that people have forgotten. So it's not just fiction, But it's all story, basically. And if you read it as story, you'll read it different than if you read it as fact, won't you? You'll ask different kinds of questions, real questions about the artists and why they painted it that way, rather than why did that happen that way. That's not the question. The question is, why did Van Gogh have the swirling clouds looking like ravens about to whatever it is, you know? Why is it that way? Why is it blue? Why isn't it red? Why is it green? Not because the field looked blue, red, green, but because of the life of the artist is trying to say something. Nowhere in this intimate contemplation better expressed than in the following statement about Moses. Yahweh used to speak to Moses face to face. In fact, the Hebrew is mouth to mouth. Pretty intimate. As one speaks to a friend. Another quote. Moses was very humble, more so than anyone on the face of the earth. Yahweh said, "Hear my words. When there are prophets among you, I, Yahweh, will make myself known to them in visions. I'll speak to them in dreams." Not so with my servant Moses. He is entrusted with all my house. Quoted in the book of Hebrews and applied to Jesus. And Jesus is presented in the New Testament as the fulfillment of Moses and way beyond Moses. Transcends everything that Moses ever was. Because the early Jews who became Christians saw Christianity as freeing Judaism from its cultural and food and sacrificial and liberating it to send the message to the rest of the world the way Abraham was right from the beginning told to do, be the father of many nations, not just one nation. So it's kind of looking back from a Christian point of view, it's hard to see why they didn't all get the message. They didn't all get it, but some did. He is entrusted with all my house. With him I speak face to face, clearly, not in riddles. He beholds the form of Yahweh. Now, what does that mean? But it means he sees something of God that no one else can see. Moses' prayer, is to conclude this first half, is portrayed as being attentive prayer, waiting on God to reveal his will. And here's a beautiful text. It's the last words of the book of Exodus. Beautiful words. Exodus chapter 40. The cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of Yahweh, the radiant beauty and presence of Yahweh, filled the tabernacle. That's why we call our tabernacle in our church the tabernacle, of course. Whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the Israelites would set out on each stage of their journey. But if the cloud was not taken up, they did not set out until the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of Yahweh was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, before the eyes of all the house of Israel at each stage of their journey. So they didn't move till God told them to move. Then when they settled, struck camp somewhere or made their camp, they stayed there. And God, this is a story, God revealed his will by raising the cloud, and then they knew to go on. But what that's got to say in our life is, it's not obvious. I mean, it's not difficult, is it, to say? In other words, we have to discern the will of God for us, and through spiritual direction more than anything, and speaking to a wise person, and waiting till we have peace and are equally willing. That's what St. Ignatius Loyola puts it, and I haven't seen it put better anywhere else. And you've got to be equally willing. Okay, for example, this 2 weeks' time, my assessment as a priest, I've been 3 years parish priest, or four, but forget Rome for a year, so three, you can call it, at Kippax, well, it'll be assessed, and the provincial might ask me to stay for another 3, or he might ask me to move on. And I hope you can see the only way for me to be is totally equal. To stay is good, to move on is good, and either way, I'm free. Mind you, it's easier for me to be like that than others because I haven't got a wife or kids or responsibilities outside what I'm doing. But it is easier, but it's not always easy, is it, to be equally poised between this or that. But when I'm not equally poised is no time to be making decisions. You have to work till you're there, and then your heart will tell you. Wise advice would help. Because if I really want to stay, I'm not going to be listening to the evidence. You get it? I'm going to dig my heels in or whatever. And, I mean, what a stupid thing it would be to do, because that would mean for the next 3 years I wasn't doing God's will. Can you see any point of that? I mean, so you've got to be here, and it's not always easy to be there. But it's only when you're there that you can do the will of God equally willingly. Okay.